What if the trees around us aren't just scenery, but living witnesses to history? What an interesting reframe that would be, right? The tree in your front yard witnesses you go to work and come home from work and play with your kids and mow your lawn every day, day in and day out. And many trees around the country have witnessed incredible moments in history, both positive and negative. Today, I'm joined by botanist, writer, storyteller, and one of my favorite plant ladies, Baronda Montgomery. You might remember her from a couple of years ago on the podcast. Baronda is the author of When Trees Testify, a new book that explores how trees can carry memory, trauma, and most importantly, wisdom across generations. She's also the author of one of our favorite books on our reading lists, Lessons from Plants. This conversation is really eye-opening, from ancient oaks to apple trees and willows. After this episode, you're going to completely change how you see plants and our shared past. Welcome to the Growing Joy with Plants podcast, where we not only learn how to care for plants successfully, but how to simply and affordably use our plant babies to cultivate more joy in our lives by doing so. I'm Maria, former plant killer turned happy plant lady, author of Growing Joy, The Plant Lover's Guide to Cultivating Happiness, speaker, podcaster, and most importantly, your new best plant friend. On Growing Joy with Plants, you'll find conversations about houseplant care, gardening tutorials, and wellness through the lens of plants. Hello, hello, plant friends. Welcome. I'm Maria, your host of the podcast and best plant friend. If you're new here, welcome. If you are a returning guest, welcome home. So excited to welcome back my friend Baronda, who was on the show a couple of years ago for her book, Lessons from Plants, and now for her new book, When Trees Testify, for a really interesting conversation. Before we dive in, I just want to let you know our Growing Joy in 2026 two-class experience is open for enrollment. It's two separate classes in two different Sundays in February where we reflect and release on 2025 via the lens of nature. And then how we set ourselves up for the most success in 2026 by connecting with nature's rhythms more. We need to like cut through all of the noise and chaos in this world and reconnect with nature and reconnect with ourselves. And we're going to be doing that as a community in these two classes. So you can go to growingjoywithmaria.com/2026, just 2026, to sign up. I can't wait to see you there. Now, without further ado, here is our friend Baronda. Baronda, my friend, I am so happy to have you back on the show today.
I can't tell you how excited I am. I barely slept last night just waiting for this moment.
And if I haven't loved you as much as I love you already, the fact that right before we recorded, you asked me how Frankie's doing because I've had a very sick bird at home. I'm like, she gets me. She totally gets me.
I had to know.
So what have you been up to? I mean, when was the last? So you came on my show. Was it 2021? When did your
book? It was 2021. Yeah. So it's been almost like over 4 years. I'm going on 5 years. Crazy.
So for maybe some new listeners who maybe haven't heard your episode, which you must go, we'll link it in the show notes. It was such a great conversation. Why don't you introduce us and tell you how you became the plant lady you are today?
Well, it's so amazing in a lot of ways. You know, I think about people like you who I've come to know because of a shared love for plants. Mm. But I study plants as a part of my profession, but have just come to really love thinking about being in relationship with plants, and did write this book. And I came out in April of 2021 on Lessons from Plants. And I think you and I came into each other's universe because when your book came out, there was really kind of a parallel discussion of what we have learned from plants and how we love plants.
I quoted you in my book.
It was just such an amazing life to be able to come to know other people who do have such an appreciation for the life outside of themselves, plants and otherwise. And so, you know, really just after that book and starting to have conversations with the public about plants, have just continued to explore what amazing relatives plants are on this planet.
Relatives, my new favorite word for how to speak about plants. So you have a degree in botany. While you were coming up the ranks, getting your degrees, like what aspects of botany did you study professionally before you started writing books?
Yes. So what I've studied for a very long time, almost longer than I want to admit, almost three decades now, is understanding how plants see light, how they understand what the light environment they're in. And once they have an understanding of what that light environment is, how they match their growth and behavior to that. So plants can sense which direction light is coming from, how bright it is, how many hours of sunlight they're getting a day, which helps them know whether it's spring or summer or fall. And then we would study how that, once that's been perceived by the plants, how that translates into a change in their behavior, whether they're making leaves in the spring or dropping leaves in the fall.
Okay. Wow. So you've dedicated your life to studying light. Yes. And now you're so much more than a botanist. You know, you're an activist, you're a historian, you're a storyteller in your first book and really in this second book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I believe we talked about this in our last conversation, but you're a fan of braiding sweetgrass, right?
With absolutely. Absolutely.
Miranda, when I was reading your book, I was like, oh my God, this is braiding sweetgrass for the Black experience in America.
Yeah. Well, like, that's, yeah.
Yeah.
That's high praise.
Is that something that was in your mind? Like the way that you weave botany, your personal family history and lineage and history I was like, oh my God, it's done as masterfully as Robin did for the Native American experience. It's incredible. Yeah.
Thank you so much. It's interesting because I think one of the reasons I was so drawn to Robin Wall Kimmerer's work initially is that it felt familiar to me to approach life through an honoring of your roots, an honoring of the natural world, and to tell that through stories. And when I was writing the book, you know, I wasn't necessarily holding that at the front of my mind. But when the book was about to come out, I've seen somewhere, I think even the publishers describe it as Braiding Sweetgrass meets How the Word Get Passed by Clint Smith. Mm. Mm. And I was a big fan of his work as well. And so I thought at first I was like, oh, my goodness, don't put that out there. That's a high bar. But I now see it as an honor because I think one of the reasons I'm so drawn to both of their work is that it felt familiar to me to meet the world through stories, honoring your roots, and really bringing that forward through culture. So I accept that with all humility, but find that very heartwarming.
Yeah, it's so beautiful. And I think in order to really make an impact, you kind of do need all three. You need the botany by itself is too dry, right?
Yes.
History
yes.
by itself might be too intimidating or scary.
Yes.
Personal experience is so moving. You tell amazing experiences of your growing up and your ancestors, but also like that becomes something different too, more of a memoir.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But when you're able to weave it, it just locks in so much in like such a deeper, familiar way. Even
Thank
for someone
you.
Like me who doesn't have the familiar story,
yes.
but I'm able to register and comprehend it too in a different capacity.
Well, and what I love about that is I think it is the power of us being able to share our personal stories is that even like you're saying, you don't have the familiarity with the history of family, but human, we really have this deep shared experience.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, one of the things I love also about your saying that it's so beautifully braided together in a way, is that I really did set out, the one thing I set out to do was to write a book that I felt uniquely positioned to do. And I think that, you know, sharing the family stories, reckoning with the history myself of this country and my family's history and Black Americans' history, but also I love plants and I wanted to weave in some of the core plant science. So it really was an attempt to write something I felt uniquely positioned to do, but mm-hmm. something that I also speaks into a space that I think we need to step into. And that's that, you know, we live in a country that sometimes tries to erase parts of people's history, part of our country's history. And to do that, you're erasing people. And so the personal part of it was as important because I think we need to see each other and our stories and the connections to history and our love, my love for plant science. And so I wanted to write something I felt uniquely positioned to do.
Yes, totally. Anyone who loves plants is going to absolutely love this book. And it's incredible. What brought you to write this book after your first one? Like, how did you walk us through, like, kind of catch us up between 2021 and now, like, what's been going on in your life? Where did you get the inspiration for this? You've moved a couple times, right?
So I have. Yeah. Well, I'm smiling because right before I got on this podcast, I was texting with my son, 23-year-old son, Nicholas. And the origin of this book, he loves to hear because it started with a trip to a former plantation that I absolutely did not want to take. I was putting my foot down, not wanting to go. But this would have been while I was still writing lessons from plants, actually.
Wow. Okay.
And so we took a trip to a plantation in South Carolina. I want to say it was 2018, I believe. And we were in South Carolina just for tourism. My son, my sister, and I, we travel together quite frequently. And we always have something that each of us loves to do. And I had dragged them to Botanical Gardens and the Arboretum and all these things. And they are Black history buffs. Like, they just love Black history. And they wanted to visit a former plantation. And I said to them, I have no interest in that. Takes me to a history I'm not really wanting to engage on vacation. And they said, no, we oohed and aahed and loved every plant you showed us. And this is what we want to do. So I went with so much trepidation that the fact that that visit led me to think deeply about trees, old trees, and to write this book. My son will not let me forget, right? He's like, you know, yeah, looks like this book is going to do quite well, the book you didn't want to write. And so I share that because I think, you know, that's also part of our experience is a collective experience. And if I had just stuck with what I wanted to do, I wouldn't have even had that kind of initial encounter with this nearly 600-year-old oak tree in South Carolina that led me to think about that. And so I love the fact that it's rooted in a family experience with very personal kind of aspects of that that led me to start thinking about it. But also, as I was thinking about specific trees, I also was very interested and intrigued, what's the science of this tree? And I didn't want to write a book that was just a story about my life in Black history. I'm not a historian. Plants are the way I actually see myself as connected in this world. And so it ultimately evolved into this kind of personal story, historical story, plant science story that I'm really proud of. Yeah.
Yeah. Can you speak a little bit to why you were so uncomfortable going and this concept of land trauma that is kind of also threaded throughout your book? Something that really opened my eyes as someone with extreme privilege to not experience that. Can you speak to that and what that experience is like for you?
Absolutely. So land trauma is this kind of phenomena that many African Americans in the U.S. who are descended from people who were enslaved connect agricultural practices, the land on former plantations, immediately to the trauma that their ancestors would have endured while they were enslaved. And I first started to really encounter land trauma intersecting with my life when early in my career as a plant scientist, I was often the only Black person or Black woman who was in a particular class, in a graduate program, in a department. And one of the things that I was working with some other people from underrepresented backgrounds is to say, how do we increase the number of students who are interested in studying agricultural, studying plants? And there's a kind of record that sometimes it's hard to get African-Americans to think about doing that because of this link back to, in this nation, being descended from people who would have been enslaved. And so the idea of visiting a plantation to me as a tourism site and not knowing what the other tourists, what their attitude would be, whether they would see it as a sacred space, whether they would both, you know, I understand that the life of formerly enslaved people is not all trauma. There was joy, there was marriage, there was all of those things. But to go there and not know how it was going to be treated was what was really giving me a lot of trepidation. And so I said, you know, if I go there and someone annoys me, we have to leave right away. And my sister said, you know, that's not how you get to show up in the world. You know, she said, that's not even who you are, teaching about mentoring and all of these things. And so I really had to face some of my own kind of personal ideas about what it means to visit a space where some of my own ancestors might have been enslaved. And that was really a hard thing to navigate. But I think if I had walked away from it, I wouldn't have had the experiences that I've had to reflect on it and to try to share some of those reflections. So I think part of what I hope to do is what I did in the first book is, how do we have difficult conversations through a lens of nature, through a lens of plants, through a lens of us being one part of the globe, not the full focus.
Yeah, it's interesting thinking about the word trauma and now, you know, only recently, like trauma-informed therapy, trauma-informed container holding, trauma-informed is a word we use. And you think about these plantations and these places where the history, it's sacred and deeply upsetting. And yeah, is your tour guide trauma-informed too? Yeah. Do they get training so that all people can have the experience that they're supposed to have there? Yeah. I'd love for you, I mean, your introduction when you talk about this experience with this tree is so incredible. I mean, I'd love for you to share a little bit more about the McCaffrey, right? That was the name of it?
The McCloud tree. Yeah.
Can you share a little bit more of what happened with this initiation?
Absolutely. You know, even as I'm joking about how my sister and son insisted, they are really thoughtful. And one of the things that you just talked about, you know, when you go to a former site, do you have someone who is trauma-informed, culturally responsible in the way that they treat it? And there are some sites who take that as a part of how they practice welcoming visitors. And the McLeod Plantation happens to be one where they try, as much as they talk about the history of the entire plantation, they try to focus on the life of African Americans there. So when we got, I drug my feet that morning when we woke up. We were going that morning. We woke up. I said, I don't think I feel well. And my son said, you feel just fine.
So we've talked more and more on this podcast about gardening, not just for beauty, but for the environmental impact. And that's why I'm so excited to share this new book that's just come out. It's called The Essential Guide to Ecological Gardening, and it's by the American Horticultural Society. So it helps you understand your garden as a living system, soil, plants, water, insects, all interconnected, working together. And it also shows you how small, thoughtful choices can lead to healthier plants and a more resilient garden overall. And this book, because it's by the American Horticultural Society, it's really comprehensive. So if you've listened to this podcast before, you've heard we do entire episodes on topics like water conservation or the Leave the Leaves, you know, campaign every autumn. But this book brings all of these different topics on ecological gardening under one roof or under one cover. It talks about building better soil, conserving your water, supporting pollinators, and making plant choices that actually fit your landscape and local wildlife. So if you're curious about gardening in a way that's a little more gentle on the planet and more rewarding for you, pick up a copy of The Essential Guide to Ecological Gardening by the American Horticultural Society wherever books are sold. Once again, that's The Essential Guide to Ecological Gardening by the American Horticultural Society wherever books are sold. Espoma Organic is a 90-year-old family-owned and operated company dedicated to making safe indoor and outdoor gardening products for people, pets, and the planet. And as we prep for garden season, plant friends, know that Espoma Organic has your back with high-quality options for your indoor and your outdoor plant collections. If you're starting seeds, start them in the Espoma Organic Seed Starter Mix. Then you're going to plant them up in your garden with the Biotone Starter Plus. And then throughout your gardening season, you're going to use their wide array of plant foods or fertilizers called tones that are curated specifically for whatever you're growing. They have a large array of garden soils and composts for however you're growing, whether you're growing in containers or raised beds or in ground. And if you're a houseplant parent, keep it simple like I do and use their general potting mix for all of your houseplants and their liquid indoor houseplant food, which is a super gentle houseplant fertilizer created specifically for houseplants that is gentle enough you could put it in your watering can every time you water your plants. And to top it all off, Espoma has a huge sustainability commitment with 100% solar-powered plant, zero-waste manufacturing, and eco-friendly packaging. To learn more about their indoor and outdoor products, visit Espoma.com to see where your local Espoma dealers are, or you can click the link in the show notes to go to my Espoma Amazon storefront where I've curated all my favorite products that I've been using for years. Thanks, Espoma. Then your son is like, Mom, we're going.
And so he said,
botanical garden. Like,
yeah. Well, and you know what I love about him, it's both frustrating and endearing, is that he will say the thing you would have said to him. Right. And so then you can't argue with it. He said, I know you think you don't feel well, but that's not physical. So then all the way there, it looked like it was going to rain. And I said, oh, it's going to rain. And I said to my sister, the rain's going to mess up your hair. She said, it's OK. I'll put it in a ponytail. You know, just I was coming up with whatever I could. And so when we got there, I just kept saying, come rain, come down, please. And we got there. And even when we got there, I think they could see I was very quiet. And when I'm agitated or not sure what's going on in the world, I'm very quiet. But when we got there, I said, I don't want to ruin their experience. You know, of all the things, my sister's my best friend, my son, I try to be the absolute best mother that I can. So I said, I want to ruin their experience. And as we started to walk around, my son, being as thoughtful as he was, started to point out plants. Like, maybe she'll get, you see over there, there's this plant.
Okay.
But right ahead of us as we were walking towards the big house where the enslaver would have lived was this beautiful tree. And I have always loved trees just because of their complicated makeup and everything, but it was just massive. And when the person who was leading the cultural tour guide was leading the tour said it's thought to be 400 to 600 years old, immediately I said this tree would have been living when people were enslaved here, right? And because I am a person who understands how plants get built, I immediately said their breath would have been breathed right in this tree the way ours is, the carbon dioxide taken up, and their breath is a part of the tree. And I'm just saying this matter-of-factly, right? It's a fact of plants. And my sister and son looked at me and said, what do you mean? And it really occurred to me how powerful it was to stand with the same tree that enslaved people would have stood with, right? There are a few things that we can point to that would have been in the same space with our ancestors, but a living thing that was living at that time, that just became so deep, like deeply rooted in me. And then I, you know, as I said, I was still writing Lessons from Plants. So I kind of put that to the side, but I did, I believe in 2020 when Lessons from Plants came out, as you might, you mean, you've written a book. Sometimes when your book comes out, you're invited to have conversations or write an article. I wrote an article about seasons and this tree. And after I wrote that article, I became obsessed with trees and just kept writing more. And then it became pretty clear to me that it was likely that that might be the next book. And so it's like such a 5 years later to be sitting here with the book done, thinking about that starting experience. I think the other thing I think about with that experience is that it's important to do things sometimes that make you uncomfortable because you don't know what growth you might have from facing the discomfort. And I'm really glad that I did.
Yeah, the cave you fear to enter holds the treasure that you
see. Yes, 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 absolutely.
It's so right. It's so real.
Yes.
I had a yoga teacher who said this to me like 10 years ago, and I still think about it. And he said, the pose only begins when you start to get uncomfortable.
I love that.
Yeah. And that has just always stuck with me. You know, that's normally where the riches are. You know, your title of the book, When Trees Testify, this concept of tree communication is also so threaded in your book, and really viewing trees as relatives, as living beings, as witnesses to our history, in addition to just being these things that we plant in our front yards.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about that? What does tree communication or plant communication mean to you?
So I think about plant communication and tree communication in multiple ways, right?
Mm-hmm.
They can actually communicate with each other through chemicals, through touches, there's a communication that they initiate to kind of figure out where they are in the world and what they should be doing. There is, to me, the communication that they have with us. So I think about when I smell a rose, it immediately takes me to a certain place.
Mm-hmm.
When I see a lily, it immediately takes me to a certain place. And so to me, they're communicating to us as well through their presence and beauty. And so many of us have a scent, a taste, so many of which are plant-derived spices, something that's linked to our place in the world. So I think there's this communication of them living together with you. But then when I thought about the title of this book, and I like so many cases, I had the title before I had written much of it. So in the U.S., there was actually a phenomenon, still sometimes you'll see it, people will talk about witness trees. And it's an old tree that might have been standing at the site of a war or a battle, or that might have been standing. And so when I was thinking about witness trees, to me, a witness only has power when they testify. And so I really wanted this to be a story about the power of these trees. As there's a writer, Taya Miles, I think, who she wrote a book about Ashley Sack, but she talked about trees as material witnesses. And I think for me, a material witness, the power is when they're able to testify of what they've seen, testify of what they've experienced. And so that's why for me, the testify was about these trees having a different form of communication, not the communication they're having with each other, not the communication when we smell their scent, but the fact that they're standing in a particular place can, if we're interested, give us an idea of what have they lived through? Who have they lived with?
Mm-hmm.
They're carrying the breath of these individuals. What's the story behind it? And so I think trees can communicate in so many different ways. And my goal was to allow these species of trees and the cotton shrub that I was focused on in the book to kind of testify of my life, my family's life, but also a larger historical project of the nation.
Yeah, it's so brilliant. Because the focus of the book is the trees, obviously, and their testimony, but also it's allowing for these untold stories of, you know, Black people who created grafting, like people, you know, that incredible.
Yes. Pecan.
enslaved person. I'm blanking on his Antoine, who, you know, well, I'll let you tell the story, but you also shedding light to these stories that are often forgotten or overlooked. And it's just like the trees, like often just overlooked. People don't look at trees with the reverence and wisdom that I think they deserve. And this book makes you open your eyes in so many different capacities. Can you share the story about your pecan? So your book, you have seven trees and the cotton plant, right? And each book has a chapter on the tree, and you really beautifully weave, you know, history, family and botany through it. And these voices that have been erased, these scientific discoveries, especially as a botanist. Can you share a little bit?
Yeah, so I knew pretty early that pecan would be one of the trees that was captured in the book, because my family's history with pecan, like there were always baskets of pecans around at Christmas time. But also I had become aware through the book by Taya Miles that I mentioned earlier and some other writings that there was an enslaved person named Anton who was the first to successfully draft pecan so that it could be commercialized. So one of the things about pecan, like many plants in nature, is that if you look at the seeds or fruit that they produce, they are very varied in nature, in size, in flavor. And for commercial purposes, you want something that if the customer buys it, it's always going to taste the same. So a pecan tree in nature makes lots of very small pecans. One season it may make small, next it's big. It's not a reproductive. Highly reproducible. And so Anton, who was enslaved on a farm, was tasked by his enslaver to graft pecan trees so that they would reproduce very reproducible pecans with a lot of nut meat that was of high quality. And so that required grafting a rootstock that was very durable to the stems that would make the pecans. And grafting is a difficult thing to do.
Yeah. And back then when, I mean, there weren't like scientific videos or...
No. So it's trial and error and apprenticeship. So, you know, Anton had apparently already been a very good gardener. And so they said, okay, maybe he would be able to do it. And so it took a long time for him to produce what became known as a centennial pecan, which was like the first commercial variety that really started the pecan industry in the U.S., right? And so many people would not know that the roots of the pecan industry, which was quite lucrative for many countries, I mean, states in the South, as well as New Mexico, started due to this botanical expertise of an African-American. And so when I started to think about stories like that, you know, I've often been looking at my own career as a plant scientist, and a lot of people are like, oh, you're the first hired at Michigan State, first Black woman plant scientist hired at Michigan State. And I started to think, I might have been the first here, but there's a deep botanical expertise that sits at some of the most innovative parts of what happened in U.S. agriculture that led to commercial industries. And also going back to that point I made earlier, how could we get other African-Americans interested in botany? If you know you're coming from this deep legacy of botanical expertise, maybe that counteracts some of the idea of land trauma. And so then to go back into these spaces as professionals, to go back into spaces as farmers, is actually reclaiming a legacy as opposed to just grappling with the trauma. And I'm always wanting to face the entirety of the world. I never ask people to ignore their trauma, but also don't leave behind the nuggets of expertise, wisdom, and legacy that may help carry you forward as you navigate trauma.
Yeah, similar to your studies of light and light and dark.
Yes.
It's like we inherit in our genetics, like we inherit trauma, we inherit wisdom and
absolutely
intuitive connection. And yeah, that's so encouraging. When you started as a botanist, was that a prevalent, you're reclaiming your ancestry? Was that prevalent when you started, or you only started recognizing it when you noticed you were in rooms and you were the only Black person, or you kept getting these first acknowledgments?
Yes.
Like, when did you kind of step into that?
I think it was a gradual process. So when I first started to study botany, you know, I'm thinking about, I was just recently talking to a young woman who is going to go into studies and do studies in plants because she's interested in Black farmers in the Midwest. That wasn't my origin story. From a very young age, wanted to be a lawyer. Thought I was going to be a lawyer for lots of reasons. You know, I wanted to sue a neighbor when I was five and my parents wouldn't give me a lawyer. So I'm like, I'm going to become a lawyer.
Oh my God.
And then you take all these aptitude tests. And so it seemed like a reasonable pursuit. But in middle school, it became clear I was really good at science and math. And so I started to become interested in those. And not really understanding how to fit them together, I thought I'd become a biological patent lawyer. But ultimately, in undergraduate, I decided that I really love science, the idea of just pursuing your curiosity. You're interested in a question about nature, you can pursue it. And so initially, I wasn't clear that I was going to study plants. I knew I wanted to study biology or biochemistry, but I took several classes. And I took a plant physiology class. And I really only took this class because it's one that fit my schedule. But the professor was so enthusiastic. And it became clear to me that plants were fascinating beings doing lots of things that we can't imagine. They look like they're just sitting there and then a new leaf pops out. But all of the amazing things that happen from initiating that leaf to us seeing the new leaf unfurl were just fascinating to me. And so I'm really moved into plants with that curiosity about the science of why they're so interesting. And as you say, as I started to be in rooms and realized that there were few people who looked like me and people were celebrating, I started to ask questions about why is this? And then also, I am just a deeply introspective person. And I think I started to ask the question, what unique contributions can I have in this space? And as much as I find it fascinating how plants perceive light and translate that into whether they should be making flowers or going into dormancy, I also have asked myself, what question can I uniquely engage in this space? And if I stop studying that tomorrow, someone else will pick that up and start studying it. But this intersection of African Americans in the U.S. and a botanical legacy is one, I certainly have people I share that with, but I think the numbers of us interested in that are few. And then if you look at the numbers of us who are interested in that, who are interested in writing a book for the public, it becomes fewer. And so I think it evolved over time with me asking, why am I in this space right now? And, you know, that goes back to my family of, in my family, there was always this kind of sense of we show up in the world through reciprocity. When you get something, what are you going to give? And so I was asking, what does it mean for me to sit in these spaces knowing this much about plants, to care deeply about all people in the U.S., including my own African-American history, and to ask, how do I want to use that? And so I think it was a gradual kind of productive walk towards where I am now.
It's so inspiring. And it's such a universal truth of what are my gifts here that I uniquely can share?
Yes.
And I don't know if everyone gives that enough thought for yes. What am I uniquely here to do that really, especially like the degree in botany, the degree, you know, the son who's a history buff, who I'm sure yes. really helped you with, you know, research for this book. It's really incredible. And also how you've been, you know, divinely, spiritually, whatever you want to call it, but mm-hmm. like led, happening yes. to take that plant science class, happening yes. to be dragged to this, you know, tourism thing that you didn't want to do. What, every chapter in the book is so beautiful. What plant particularly or tree spoke to you the most? Like, which chapter was the most personal for you to write?
I think the chapter that has so deeply impacted me is the chapter on willows. And that is because of the connection with my maternal grandfather.
Mm.
And when I first was thinking about writing When Trees Testify and looking at a list of trees that I was going to include, to be quite honest, I can't say that I was so deeply focused on that until I saw this news story in 2019 about a memorial willow tree that had been desecrated in Arkansas. And so I was living in Michigan at the time. And so I hear tree, I hear Arkansas, and I tune in to this story in a deep way. And the town that they named that was being memorialized by this tree was Elaine, Arkansas. And I'm like, my grandfather was born there. And so I tell a story in When Trees Testify about how hearing that news story and then starting to ask questions about when my grandfather was there, when would he have been there at a particular time, we unearthed a family story that we had not been aware of, that my grandfather was actually living in Elaine, Arkansas in 1919 when an anti-Black massacre happened. And my grandfather was this kind of quiet, stoic, thoughtful person. And now I think back to all the times that I sat with him, not knowing this history. And so that chapter is so deeply personal because it felt like a chance to unearth a family history that we weren't aware of. But it's also a history that other African-Americans in a lot of cities, unfortunately, would have connections with, because Elaine, Arkansas was not an isolated event. In fact, 1919 was known as the Red Summer, because there were multiple events. And so I think, you know, it's asking me about I know when this book comes out, people are going to say, which is your favorite? It's so hard to choose a favorite, like people who have multiple children. But the way you asked that question, which one deeply, that chapter so deeply resonated with me, because there are individuals. There was a professor, Brian Mitchell, at the University of Arkansas, who was studying Elaine, Arkansas for a long time. I mentioned him in the book. And so writing that chapter was a way to honor people who've been studying this, to honor and unearth a kind of family history, and then to say to the world, this is part of my family's history. It's a part of many families' history in the U.S. And so that chapter, and then my sister, Renee, who is my best friend, read an advanced copy of the book recently. And she said, oh, that Willow chapter. So I also recognize that it's going to be a gift to some family members to learn about this family history. And so that chapter is deeply, deeply personal.
Yeah, that's so beautiful, especially that your whole family gets to enjoy the benefits of that. Also, I found the Willow chapter so moving, particularly about how Willow was usually what was planted, you were talking about, for like unmarked graves. So now it's known that if you see a cluster of Willow trees, it could be a burial site.
Yes, yes, yes. So, and you know, it's believed that that's a practice that came over from parts of West Africa with some of the enslaved people, where you would bury a tree, kind of a living headstone, where people had been buried. And in fact, in some places where they know land was a former plantation, they can look for where there are patches of trees and ask, is that a place where there may be a burial ground?
Oof. Talk about bearing witness. Talk about bearing witness. And also, if we open our eyes enough to seeing, to knowing the significance of the willow, and then knowing, oh, this could be a historical site of some sort that we don't even know about, or that more people should know about.
Well, and that's one of the things that I think about globally. I think there are ways in which sometimes trees are critically important if you know what to look for. I was recently in Seoul, South Korea, with a couple of friends from work. And we were going to see one of the tunnels that had been discovered to connect South Korea to North Korea. And one of them said that this tunnel was found because the person looking noticed a tree that was somewhere. And so, you know, I'm in the middle of South Korea. I'm like, look, there's a tree. And my friend said, can we just be somewhere without a tree story? I said, no. Apparently we cannot. So I think the ways in which someone who read When Trees Testify said, David Joyce Haskell, I think, said, I'll never look at trees the same. And I think that's part of the goal, I hope, is that the book invites people to think about living beings around them in a different way, particularly ones that have been here for centuries.
Yes. And that they are the wisdom keepers. They hold so much. In the book, in the conclusion, you talk about this concept of Sankofa, of going back to retrieve the parts of yourself. I love this. I love this concept. Yeah. What did it mean to you? This book must have been just the ultimate journey of Sankofa.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know, it's so interesting. The first time I heard the word Sankofa, I think, would have been as an undergraduate when I took an African-American history class. But as the professor, as she was describing it, several of us looked at each other, because it felt like a practice we had experienced in our lives, in our families. And I just think about how, whether it's a family member or someone else, this calling back to memory on something that's happened in the past and bringing the wisdom of that moment forward. And then, you know, for me, I also think about, how am I living now that will allow my future generations of relatives to have Sankofa? So for me, it's not just my standing in a place. Certainly, I feel a powerful responsibility, a powerful privilege, actually, to be in a moment with this book where, yes, Sankofa for Anton in terms of the pecan, Sankofa for my grandfather in the telling of the willow, Sankofa for my personal family in the cotton chapter, like my mother and father, but also other generations. But then for me, I think that if you only think about it from that perspective, how you are the purveyor of bringing someone forward, that can take you into hubris too quickly, right? In terms of, look at me, I get to bring this forward. But I think daily about what kind of life of I'm living that will allow future generations to have a good Sankofa, to bring something good forward. And so for me, it becomes a principle that pairs powerfully with reciprocity in terms of, how do you both honor those who were before you, but live an honorable life.
Oof, that's beautiful. Also, reciprocity, like nature's number one lesson, you know, and how it sounds like that was really important growing up for you.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Of all of the trees and plants that you talked about in your book. Is there one that you feel like either you were surprised by or people will be surprised by is included? Like, who's the unsung hero of the book? Obviously, people know about cotton, you know, yeah. People know about the tree, the lynching tree. What's the name
poplar.
Of it?
Poplar.
The poplar. What do you feel like? Do you feel like there is one that a lot of people are going to walk away thinking, man, I had no idea?
I think people may be surprised to have the apple tree included. I mean, I don't think the apple tree is one that, if you ask people to think of plants or trees associated with enslavement in the U.S., as you said, poplar may come forward, maybe even oak, because there's so many oak trees in Charleston and Savannah and other places. But I think if you say apples included without any other context, people might ask why. Mm. Apple came to be included in the book because of two different events. One was the privilege I had to be a part of the founding Black Botanists Week. I mean, that emerged after the events in the summer of 2020 after George Floyd, when Christian Cooper had an encounter with a white woman in the Central Park. And then Black Birders Week came out just to say there are Black people who bird, who are here. Let's celebrate that. And so then several weeks emerged. And I was privileged to be a part of that. That was the original founder, Tanisha Williams, a plant scientist. And as a part of that, I came to know about a town, a Black settlement in New Mexico called Blackdom, from one of the co-founders, Maya. And so in reading that story and hearing about it, apple tree emerged in the middle of that. And I thought, I don't know if that would be a full chapter. But then as I continued to read about apple, someone asked me, are you aware of this children's book? It was a book called An Apple for Harriet Tubman. And Harriet Tubman had a real love for apple trees. She had to help raise them when she was enslaved on a farm and couldn't eat them. So when she was free, it became this symbol of I can grow them now and eat them. And so I think the apple chapter is one that would not have been a predicted chapter, but it's a powerful chapter because for me, I didn't want to just live in the trauma of trees connected with African Americans, because African Americans are, like all humans, so complex. We're more than our trauma.
Of course.
And for me, with the apple, there was a kind of freedom and hope and pursuit of freedom angle that I really wanted to be able to include. Besides the fact that I love the personal childhood story I was able to tell about my obsession with apple seeds, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think that one might be a little bit surprising initially, but hopefully after people are able to read it, it's like, yeah, apple belongs there right alongside poplar.
Totally.
In the full trajectory.
Totally. And even the ones that are popular and that you'll know, you'll learn something new, because this book is so... How long did it take you to write this book? The research is extensive.
So it's hard to say because I started to think about it. But
you were still writing lessons from plants.
I was still writing lessons from plants. So I kind of wrote that one article and put it to the side. And then in 2022, I moved from Michigan to Iowa for a larger academic administrative position. And I think being an academic administrator is a stressful job. And so in 2022, late 2022 and 2023, I started to write the book in earnest because it became a time where I could escape. Like when I would sit in my room and write about, I mean, some people would read the content of that and say, how was that an escape? But I wasn't thinking about grants and hiring and students, right? And so I started to write it in earnest in 2023. So it ended up coming together more quickly than you might imagine, but maybe that's a sense of how much I needed to escape.
Wow. And where do we find you now? So you're at Harvard.
So I am on a 1-year fellowship. So I took a short leave at the end of last year to finish writing When Trees Testify. And in the middle of that, I applied for a 1-year fellowship. So I'm at a fellowship at the Radcliffe Institute. And it's a year with other fellows who are from artists to other scientists to humanists. And all of us are working on a project. So I'm here for this 1 year, actually launching When Trees Testify, but already starting the next book.
Wow. Classic. Just like you wrote, you started When Trees Testify.
It seems that's what happens. Like I get ready to launch something and I was like, I think I have another idea. I think it's because writing is a safe space for me. There's a lot going on in my world, it's like, what project can I come forward with to write? But yeah, here for a year. And then still on the faculty. So we'll see what happens. I mean, it's so much going on in the world. Sometimes I just want to escape, but I'll keep writing.
Do you miss Arkansas, or like, where would you go if you weren't in Boston?
You know, that's an interesting question. Someone asked me that recently. And I think because I've been in this state where when I first moved to Iowa, for my new job. I moved from Michigan to Iowa. My son was in college. I was empty nesting. And so I made this big move. And now I don't know exactly. There would probably, if I disappear, I'm on a beach somewhere.
Yeah.
But I think Nicholas is determined that I'm waiting to see where he lands, to see where I land. So
totally.
We shall see. And I miss Arkansas in so many ways, but the beauty is my father passed away, but my mother and siblings are still in Arkansas, so I'm able to get back.
Well, you got places to stay.
I'm able to get back.
Okay. Yeah. And I'm curious, in Boston, what does your plant collection look like? Are you gardening? Do you have houseplants? Or as a botanist, do you keep your interests, you know, at the Radcliffe Institute and not so much personally?
Yeah, so I did not bring most of my plants. I moved some of my plants to my writing studio, which gets well taken care of. I gifted some, but I have a couple of plants.
Mm-hmm.
And so usually when I move somewhere short term, I get just a few, you know, plants that I can love on. And then people here will tell you I'm always in people's offices looking at their plants. And so it's an easy way to make friends as well.
It's the easiest way to make friends just start talking about plants with the plant person.
Yes.
You are such a special friend. I'm so thankful for all the work you do. This book is so beautiful. So where can people not just find the book, but also find you, follow you as you're continuing? You're already working on the next project. So if we need to stay abreast of all things Baronda, where can we find you?
The easiest place to find everything is at BarondaMontgomery.com. But I am on Blue Sky, Baronda M. And also on Instagram, Baronda M. And I hope, you know, I'll be having some visits around the country at different bookstores. And
good, you're going
reading festivals.
Book?
Yeah.
Amazing.
And so those dates will be emerging soon on the website. And I hope I'll see some people out in the world. It's so much fun to be able to meet other people. And at some point, hopefully you and I will end up in the same place so we can meet in person.
I know.
I am just so grateful for you and your plant love as well. It's amazing. I can't wait to be in one of your sound baths. But
me too.
I love
those. We're working on it.
Yes.
Yeah, well, my in-laws are in Boston, so maybe, you know, if I'm there, we can meet for a coffee or something.
Awesome.
That would be so fun.
Well,
thank you so much. You're the best, and I can't wait to have you back to talk about book number 3.
Thank you so much, Maria.
All right, plant friends, I hope this episode makes you pause and look at that tree in your front yard or the tree in your local park differently than you've looked at it before. And if so, we've done our job. Make sure to check out Baronda and her beautiful new book, When Trees Testify, and follow her work. She's such a sweet plant lady and plant friend. I love what she's doing in the world. And like she said, she's so uniquely qualified to do what she's doing, which I absolutely love. And of course, plant friends, I also love you, and I hope that you keep growing joy this week. Plant friend, thank you for tuning in today. It means so much to me that I get to be part of your planty journey. If you like what you heard, make sure you're subscribed to the show so you never miss an episode. We have so many incredible interviews and solo episodes on incredible houseplant and gardening topics that you will not want to miss this year. And while you're over there in the podcast player subscribing, why don't you click over to the review section of Growing Joy with Plants and leave us a review? Reviews are tremendously helpful for the growth of the podcast, so thanks in advance. If you're looking for more opportunities to grow as a plant parent with Growing Joy content, we've got so many options for you. First, I highly recommend you taking the Plant Parent Personality Test. It's free. It's super fun. It takes 3 minutes to complete. At the end of the test, you're going to get your plant parent personality profile and a curated list of plants, projects, and podcast episodes that are right up your alley, tailored just for you and your lifestyle, inspired by your results. The links are in the show notes. If you're looking to uplevel your plant parent game, I have so many free downloads on my website that I think could help you, like the Understanding Natural Light download or 9 different ways to green up your office space. If you'd like to support the show monetarily and help me bring the show to as many people as possible for free, you can head to our Patreon link in the show notes to learn more about our offerings. And finally, I invite you to come hang out with me and continue the planty conversation on social media, on Instagram and TikTok. I'm Growing Joy with Maria. My DMs are always open if you have requests for topics or ideas for the show. Thank you again for listening. It is truly my honor and delight to help you keep blooming and keep growing joy.